know, got me reeling when you say, I love you, you just rave on. Just rave on. Just rave on.
All right. All right. All right. All right. All right.
One, two, three, three.
That was Gary Busey from the film The Buddy Holly Story, which was directed by Steve Rash, who now lives in Bucks County. It's 22 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. With me now on Fresh Air is Michael Harrington, who's been a leader of the American left for about three decades. He was the associate editor of The Catholic Worker, a socialist Catholic newspaper, in the 1950s. In 1960, he helped organize civil rights demonstrations at the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles. In 1965, he joined Martin Luther King Jr.'s advisory committee. Michael Harrington has also been active in the American labor movement and was active against the war in Vietnam. Through the 60s and 70s, he campaigned for presidential candidates Eugene McCarthy, Robert Kennedy, Edward Muskie, George McGovern, Mo Udall, Jimmy Carter. He chaired the Socialist Party from 68 to 72 and has been national chair of the Democratic Socialists of America since 73. They were formerly the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, and then they merged with the New American Movement and are now Democratic Socialists of America. One of Michael Harrington's first books, The Other America, was published in 1962, and it helped prompt the Kennedy and Johnson administration's war on poverty. He's currently working on a new analysis of poverty in the United States, and that book, to be called The New Poverty, is scheduled to be published in August. He's the author of about 13 books. His latest is called The Politics at God's Funeral, The Spiritual Crisis of Western Civilization, and that's published by Holt Reinhardt Winston. Michael Harrington will be speaking this evening at the House of Our Own bookstore at 3920 Spruce Street in West Philadelphia. He'll be there from 5 to 7 p.m., and for more information, you can call 222-9637. Michael Harrington, welcome back to Fresh
Air. Thanks very much.
Before we talk about the subject of your new book, can you explain what democratic socialism means?
Well, simply put, it is the democratization of basic economic and social decisions. That is to say, in the United States today, we have the right to vote politically, which is precious, which is extremely important. But decisions, let us say, about closing plants, about shipping jobs overseas, about destroying communities, decisions that affect our lives sometimes much more profoundly than the laws passed by city councils or even the Congress of the United States, are made in private boardrooms. And what democratic socialism is about is getting democratic with a small d popular decision making over these economic and social decisions which affect the lives of people so profoundly. And finally, I think that one way of putting it, the way I often put it, is that the American people have been having the wrong debate for a long time. We have been debating whether or not we should have planning, whether or not we should have government intervention in the economy, whether or not we should go back to Adam Smith's laissez-faire. And from a democratic socialist point of view, that's a futile and irrelevant debate. We are going forward to the politicalization of the American economy, Ronald Reagan, the free entrepreneur who promised us balanced budgets, is running a $200 billion deficit. The serious question is not whether we're going to have planning. The serious question is it possible to have a planning that is really controlled by the people from below? Or is it inevitable that elites, technocratic elites in boardrooms and in government, are going to make the decisions for us behind our backs on high? Democratic socialism is not the proposal of planning or government intervention. It's the proposal of bottom-up participatory planning and government intervention.
Socialism is frequently equated with communism, which is equated with the Soviet
right.
Union. What's the relationship, if any, of the Democratic Socialists of America, which you co-chaired, to the Soviet Union?
Well, we have Democratic Socialists of America is a refreshing new development in American life. It contains people with a wide variety of points of view. Some would call themselves Marxists. Some are deeply religious. Some are humanists. Some are Zionists. The most disparate group of people. We have reversed the historic trend on the American left of constantly splitting. And rather than splitting, we have united people who agree on a basic strategy in the society but disagree on many theoretical questions. Therefore, with regard to a theory of the Soviet Union, how do you define what it is? You would get many answers from members of DSA. I would call it bureaucratic collectivism. I would say it's not socialist at all. Other people might call it state capitalism or a statist socialism they don't like. What we agree on, all of us, whatever our theories of the Soviet Union may be, is that the absence of democracy in the Soviet Union means that it is nothing like the socialism we want, that it is no model for us, that we are democratic socialists, and we cannot imagine the workers, the people, the communities, controlling their environment, making these decisions, unless there's democracy. I would say, from my own point of view, that the recent succession crisis in the Soviet Union, Chernenko becoming the general secretary of the party, the key person in the entire country, there was not a single worker involved in that decision. It was not a public decision at all. That's not a model. And one of our problems is we want very much to negotiate peace with the Soviet Union. We want very much to have disarmament. Therefore, we don't want to go around talking about the Soviet Union as the empire of evil, to have a demoniac theory of the Soviet Union. We want to understand the Soviet Union as what it is, in part because of its history, not because of evil people, but because of a poor country, an isolated revolution, etc. So we have to walk a tightrope. On the one hand, we want to understand the Soviet Union. We want to negotiate and agree with the Soviet Union on issues of disarmament. On the other hand, we want to make it very clear to the American people that we stand for the Bill of Rights, we stand for freedoms of expression, religion, organization, and in that sense, we regard the Soviet Union not as a model, but an anti-model.
Is it easy to create a dialogue about democratic socialism in America since I think most people do associate socialism with communist black countries in the Soviet Union?
It's a problem, although from my own point of view, and I've been at this, as you mentioned, for over 30 years, it's a little less of one, and let me tell you why. There's still a very profound tendency in this country to equate socialism with communism and to assume when I'm introduced as a socialist that I propose to close down free trade unions, shut the churches, and establish a single-party monopoly over American society. And that has to be dealt with, but not by then turning into a red baiter in order to deal with the problem. On the other hand, I think that one of the lasting positive accomplishments of the 1960s and of the New Left in particular is that practically every college and university in the United States now has courses on Marxism, on socialism, on labor history, often taught by faculty members now in their late 30s or around 40 years of age who might have been in SDS or the Civil Rights Movement or the Women's Movement in the 60s. So I think among that rather large group of Americans, about 40% of the population, who go to college, they're at least exposed to the notion that Karl Marx was not a devil, but was, as a matter of fact, a rather profound social thinker who is not really adequately understood as the embodied in the Soviet Union. So I find in the younger generation, somewhat less of a prejudice, but it is still a profound problem, no question about it.
A lot of people would say that Marxism doesn't really apply anymore because his model was based on the factory model, that power lay in the hands of the people who own the means of production. And since we are living in what's frequently been called a post-industrial age that's service industry-oriented and information-oriented, the means of production don't exist in quite the way they did when he was formulating his theories. Do you think that Marx can be used as a model in today's society?
Well, here, let me make it clear that I speak now not for DSA, but for myself, because there are people in DSA who would disagree both to my right and to my left, so to speak, on what my answer. But my answer would be Marxism, in the sense of a Bible or a catechism with all the answers, always has been irrelevant. Marxism as a method of thinking, that emphasizes questions of power, of class, of freedom, of structures and the way structures keep exploited people from controlling their lives, I think that Marxism as a method, as an approach, as a point of view, is quite relevant. Indeed, it has inspired all of my work, and I consider myself to be a democratic Marxist. I think to take the image of post-industrial society, that is to say the notion that we've gone from goods to services and so forth and so on, and that it's really radically different. Yes and no. It is different. And for example, now when one talks about public ownership, social ownership, not just public ownership, how do you do this with technicians? How do you do this with engineers? How do you do this with office workers, where the dominant mode of economic activity is no longer workers in an assembly line? You can imagine rather easily how a plant can be operated democratically from the bottom up. But how is an office operated democratically from the bottom up? How is a television station, a radio station, et cetera? So I think new questions are posed. At the same time, I think that in this post-industrial society, the concentration of income and wealth still translates into political power in a very old-fashioned way. And it is still that one-half of 1%, the social upper class of the United States, that hires and fires all the experts. When a Daniel Bell says in his analysis of post-industrial society, that intellectuals and policy experts are now making the decisions, yes, within limits. Martin Feldstein can have his analysis. He can write his report of the Council of Economic Advisers. Ronald Reagan has the power. The intellectuals, the analysts, in my opinion, are still subordinate, and they are more often than not subordinate to money. And therefore, I think that some of the classic Marxist questions, like the redistribution of income and wealth, are as relevant or perhaps more relevant to this emergent society than they were to the smokestack society.
Well, what's the relationship of a populism or control from the bottom up, as you've put it, with input from intellectuals? How do you balance that, the intellectual judgment and the philosophical input with the grassroots input? Because the two aren't necessarily the same.
Not at all. Well, let me give you a very concrete example. One talks about democratic planning. We talk about democratic planning. I think America is moving toward planning. When I was living in France in 1963, they had indicative planning in France. The unions were given by the law the right to have seats at every level of the planning process, and nobody from the unions ever went. And I said to some of my trade union friends, why don't you go? You've got the seats. It's right there. It's in the law. And they said, we go in there. Management comes in with 50 experts. Government comes in with 50 experts. We don't know what they're talking about. I think that precisely because we are moving beyond the old industrial society, that the democratization and socialization of information and expertise is at least as important now as the democratization and socialization of wealth or of factories. Because I think if elite bureaucracies of government and corporations, if they control the computers, if they control the intellectual technology, if they define the questions, they then give the answers. Because to be able to define a question, I think, is to be able really to predict the answer. So therefore, one of the things I'm very much for, let's say in planning, is to have money for people at the base to be able to hire their experts, to get their intellectuals. When I was out about a year ago working on an article and a book, and I was in Pennsylvania in McKeesport talking to unemployed steelworkers, anti-concession steelworkers, I think those workers I talked to, I think their values are very good. I think they're very smart about power. I think they understood an awful lot about U.S. Steel and the other steel corporations that some intellectuals did not. What they lack is the ability to translate their everyday language values and insights into the kind of technical language that will allow them to challenge the companies, which will allow them to challenge the Congress, the president, et cetera. And so I think one part of the process of this next period is precisely bringing intellectual expertise and the people at the base together in a cooperative relationship, not for the people at the base to be told by the intellectuals what they want. Indeed, I would say the other way around, for the people to tell the intellectuals what they want, and for the intellectual function should, so to speak, to translate as faithfully as possible what those steel workers want into the language of computers and into the language of technical policy debate.
Are you thinking of a series of nationwide symposiums or something more ongoing?
Oh, no, I'm thinking of something like I would like to see. Well, let me give you another example. I think the American trade union movement is going to have to propose a 35-hour week or perhaps a 32-hour week as a response to the technological revolution. I don't think we can go on with a 40-hour week anymore. 1886 will be the anniversary. The 100th anniversary of the struggle for the 40-hour week is a mere 2 years away. And I hope that the American trade union movement on the 100th anniversary of the 40-hour week proclaims the 32 or the 30-hour week as a goal. So let's say a local union or an international union proposes 32 hours of work for 40 hours of pay. Immediately there are going to be 10 million experts telling them if you do this, there'll be no profits, there'll be no investment, the roof will fall in, just as one was told in the New Deal, if you let them organize, you will ruin American capitalism. It was actually the salvation of American capitalism. I would like those unions, those communities, to have the money to be able to hire their PhDs, their sociologists, their computer experts, so that when City Hall says you can't do it or you're going to wreck the whole thing, or when the federal government says you can't do it, they come up not with a vague sentiment, but we want 32 hours of work for 40 hours of pay. Here are our numbers, which will prove to you that the increased productivity you'll get out of a much more refreshed labor force will offset the loss, the increased cost of labor by 38.6%. That's what I mean, having them empowered to have their experts.
Well, Michael Harrington is my guest, and he's the national co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America and the author of the new book, The Politics at God's Funeral, The Spiritual Crisis of Western Civilization. I'd like to talk about the subject of your new book and then get back to some political principles that you're operating under and your relationship to the primaries and the election.
Sure.
So we'll get back to that in a little while. The title of your new book, The Politics at God's Funeral, presumes that religion is dying. There seems to be a lot of evidence contradicting that. There seems to be a religious revival, obviously in fundamentalism, but also amongst young families, for instance, who weren't religious when they were young, but now that they have children, feel very strongly about the importance of religion and want to pass on that religion to their children. I feel like I'm seeing this happen all around me. What evidence do you have that that there's an absence of religion?
Well, two things. First of all, let me qualify what I mean in the book by God's funeral. My proposition is very narrowly focused. Number one, it does not say that God is dead. That is a theological proposition, and I am not a theologian. I have my attitude on that question, but I didn't write a book about my attitude on that question. What I argue is that the political God of the Judeo-Christian advanced West is dying. Not that God is dying, but that the political God of the Judeo-Christian advanced West is dying. And by that I mean that in most obviously in medieval Catholicism, but also in the rise of capitalism, religion played a public role as the legitimation of political power, as a motive for hard work, as a source of psychological identity, as an expression of community, et cetera, et cetera. It had a whole series of normative functions for the entire society. It was the spirituality of the society, so to speak, and played a very important political role. What I am saying, my proposition is, that that kind of religion, a public religion based on Judeo-Christianity in the advanced West, in my opinion, is gone. Now, secondly, then to get to the immediate situation, does that mean that it vanishes overnight? Of course not. There are ups and downs. Nietzsche once said, the shadow of the dead god will be seen in caves for 1,000 years. I'm actually, I think Nietzsche, not 1,000 years. I think it'll be more rapid than that. Well, then what about the fundamentalists? As I look at the data on the fundamentalists, I think that what has happened is that there has not been a tremendous increase in fundamentalism. I think what has happened is that the fundamentalists, who really backed out of American politics at the time of the Scopes trial, were out of American politics basically politically, as a political force, from the Scopes trial until the Goldwater campaign of 64. That what has happened since 64 is there has not been an enormous increase in fundamentalism, but an increase in the visibility and political mobilization of fundamentalism. That's very important. But I, for example, in my book, I use a study by the Connecticut Mutual Life Insurance Company of religious attitudes in the United States. And I used it in part because Connecticut Mutual says this shows that religion is really on the rise. And my point is, if I can demonstrate the opposite from their figures, that I'm using figures which are supposedly against my point of view. If you look at Connecticut Mutual and look at the people who are fundamentalists in their religion, where do they come from? They're very distinct groups. They're less educated, poorer, older, blacker. Blacks tend to be more religious than whites. That is to say, more women. That is to say, I would argue they are precisely those people who have not been in the modern sector of the economy. For example, Thomas Luckman, who is one of the most interesting scholars of the sociology of religion, has pointed out that women tend to be more religious than men in America, except women who work are no more religious than men who work. That what was decisive in the gender gap in this case was not that women are genetically or biologically more religious than men, but that women, so far as they were playing the traditional role of mother and housekeeper, tended to be more traditional in their attitude towards values. That women who then go out in the economy and go to work in the paid labor market become more like men. So as I look at those figures from the Connecticut Mutual study, I would say that fundamentalists in this country were a majority around the First World War. They're perhaps 20% now. Secondly, I do think that there is also an increase in religion among middle class and college educated people. It is certainly true that when people have children, that's a time when they start thinking about religion again because they want some institution to communicate values to their kids. But my point there is I think that a kind of private religion or religion for private purposes, that could grow very much. But I don't think that those very same middle-class people that you're talking about, some of them are friends of mine, that their relation to religion is the relationship that existed, let us say, to fundamentalist America or Protestant America in the 19th century or to medieval Catholicism. It's private. It is for the family. It is for the children. As opposed to giving them the norms that will on how they will decide on economic and social policy, giving them the reason why they work. They are not working to give glory to God. One of the reasons that Calvinists worked was to give glory to God. Very few people in this society do that. I think here, by the way, one last point on America. America is a unique society in almost everything. It is, alas, the only advanced industrial society without a mass socialist movement. It is also the advanced industrial society with the highest number of people who believe in God. If Walter Dean Burnham, the political scientist, did a marvelous chart in a book called The Hidden Election, and an essay in that book, in which on one axis he put GNP and on the other axis he put church attendance. If you take the United States and Canada out, there is a one-to-one correlation between GNP and church attendance, i.e., the more GNP, the less church attendance. The United States comes in at about the level of Indonesia, that is to say, a relatively advanced third world country. We're peculiar. But I think one of the reasons, and Seymour Martin Lipset, the sociologist, has written, I think, very perceptively about this in a book called The First Nation, and Max Weber understood it. America has always had religion a mile wide and an inch deep. One of the things that Weber said when he came to the United States, he was amazed that he went to church. He was one of the greatest sociologists of religion who ever existed. And he rarely heard about doctrine, that the standard attitude you get from the pulpit is, well, you should believe in something. But if you believe in something, okay. Eisenhower once made the great statement, it goes something like, I think every man should believe in religion and I don't care what it is. That attitude would be absolutely unthinkable to a 17th or 18th century Calvinist, to a 19th century American Calvinist. So what I'm saying is I think the fundamentalist revival has been exaggerated. I think there is a very considerable persistence of religion, but it is not that public religion, that social religion, that source of political legitimacy. And I don't think those middle class people who are returning to religion because they become parents trust Ronald Reagan anymore, or even if Walter Mondale or Glenn or Jackson or whoever becomes president would trust them because of their religion. That used to be. It is no longer. And that's why I think that we have a social crisis as the result of the disappearance not of God but of the social God.
Well, America has always been a country that has tried to operate on the principle of the separation of church and state.
Right.
Can you give us some examples of how you think they haven't been separated in America?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, I would argue that one of the reasons that religion is stronger in the United States than in the other advanced industrial society is that this country never had an established church. And I think that has been quite real. We Americans take it for granted that there should be an absolute smorgasbord of religions, that there are 206 Protestant denominations, that there are the Jewish, et cetera. Now, recently, lots of Eastern religions, Buddhists, and so forth and so on. That's not true in Sweden. In Sweden, there was the Lutheran State Church. In England, the Episcopalian. In Scotland, the Presbyterian, et cetera. And I think one of the deadly things for a religion, one of the things, the easiest ways to destroy religion is to make it an official religion, because that means the minute that people get critical of the official establishment, they simultaneously get critical of all the archbishops and so forth. I was in Israel last summer. I think the same thing is true in Israel. Israel is one of the most secular societies I've ever seen in my life. I was there in Tel Aviv on two Sabbaths. And as far as I could tell, most of the people were at the beach, not at the synagogue. So I think that one of the reasons America is exceptional is that we've had the separation of church and state. That religion has been a private and voluntary affair, but it also I think religion has been a very social affair. It has not been theologically deep. As somebody put it, if you go from the early American theologians to Reinhold Niebuhr, there's about 100 years where there's not a serious theologian in the United States. We have not produced interesting theological ideas until, I think, fairly recently.
What social effect do you think it's had on Americans to not have a religious motivation for political action?
I think that there is a certain sense of drift in this society, a certain sense of purposelessness that is what this society is about. Is it more GNP? Is it simply higher material living standard? Does that exhaust its meaning? Is there any purpose that transcends the private, the individual, the material? I think there once was. I grew up in a religious Catholic family. I was a very religious Catholic myself as a young person. And I was taught, my father was a lawyer, and I remember being told by my mother about during the Depression, which was not an easy time. A client came to my father and essentially he was a patent lawyer, wanted him to harass somebody who had a legitimate patent and which this client, this corporation was infringing. And the corporation knew it, but they thought that the inventor was a poor man, and if they tied him up in the courts long enough, he would settle for a dime on the dollar, so to speak. And I remember my mother saying to me very proudly, "Your father refused to take that case. He would. He regarded that there is something. There are obligations which are superior to your own advantage, to even making money for your family in the middle of the Depression." I find that I teach at Queens College and the City University of New York. My students, this is my perception of them, they're going out into an economy that has very little that's meaningful for them. Most of them, they're the first generation of their family to go to college. Many of them come from what I would call working class homes. Their parents are trade unionists. They want to get into the middle class. They're taking courses in accounting. They're getting ready to go to law school. They don't like accounting. They don't really want to go to law school. They would like to have some work that is meaningful. They don't see any. And I think that that's a problem for young people. It's a problem for the entire society. And I think values are in crisis in this society, and I think it will affect the way we work and live.
So you see this vacuum in the philosophical center of America now, because there isn't that religious motivation,
right,
for politics or for economics,
right,
since we don't have a state church. What are you suggesting to fill that void?
I want to be very careful. Not a new religion. I think all man-made religions which are concocted in order to give something to the people so that they can believe tend to be patronizing, contemptuous, and they often wind up being totalitarian or authoritarian. And those political religions of the type of Nazism or Stalinism or what have you are, to coin a phrase, god-awful. And I do not think we can put in the West the traditional God back together again. I think that, and let's say some of my friends who are Catholics today, I think they are much more serious Catholics. There are fewer Catholics going to church. But I think precisely because going to church has now become more of a personal moral decision, many of the Catholics who go to church are better Catholics. I do not think that big is necessarily better in religion. Therefore, I think among religious people, including some of these younger people now returning to religion often because they become parents, that there is a real concern with values, that they feel this void, that that's why they are reaching out. Yet they know that the church cannot play that public role anymore. And what I think we need is, number one, for atheists and believers, for everybody concerned with values, to get together and say there is no longer one way to get to values. There really never was, but certainly there is not now. There is a Catholic way. There are a variety of Protestant ways. There are atheist ways. There are Jewish ways. There are Muslim ways. What is important is that those of us who care about values join together. It is not unimportant whether Catholics are right about theology or Jews or Protestants or Muslims. That's very important, but it's not important for politics. A united front of the believers and the unbelievers. I think, by the way, it's happened somewhat. It happened in the 60s and 70s in the anti-war movement, in the civil rights movement. I think there is a sense in which the environmental movement is a movement which has very religious implications, because what it is about, it is about the holiness of the earth, about the holiness of humanity. And you can believe in that holiness even though you don't believe in God. You can believe that there is something sacred about earth, air, water, fire, and humanity. So I think that it has happened. I think it should happen more. All the village atheists, I disagree profoundly with. Secondly, I think to understand that there is a moral dimension to economic and social policy. Let me be very precise. I think that historically religion was the expression of community. That is one of the main things it was. That religion was the sacrament of a community. It was the way first a tribe, then a city, eventually a nation, identified themselves. Who are you? We are originally the descendants of the eagle, the descendants of this or that god. Later on, much more sophisticated, we are Catholics, Protestants, Jews, what have you. And I think as community has been destroyed by this restless society, by our kind of unplanned, often carcinogenic urbanism, as we are now destroying communities throughout the Midwest and the East in the old smokestack centers, that has not simply economic consequences. It has spiritual consequences. It is tearing people away from their roots. And therefore, I would say, let us say in questions of town planning, in questions of full employment planning, regional planning, et cetera, one of the values that should be introduced in politics is community. And it should be argued for not simply because it is good for many other reasons, but also because it, I think, might make more possible people coming together, and one of the places they can come together is churches, and one of the places they can come together is in secular political groups, but coming together to express their values. I often quote a toast that John Maynard Keynes once made to the Royal Society of Economists. Keynes said, "To the economists, not the trustees of civilization, but the trustees of the possibility of civilization." And my argument is to this notion of mine of the atheists and the believers coming together on the basis of some transcendental values which are motivated both by atheism and religious belief, I would say to that coalition of the atheists and the believers, not the trustees of morality and spirituality, but perhaps the trustees of the possibility of spirituality and morality, to create a society not in which people will have this or that spirituality, but in which it is more likely that people will discover values, spirituality. And I want to steer very much clear from any political party adopting a spiritual platform. It would be more garbage than one could stand.
How would you describe yourself in terms of religion?
Well, in a very paradoxical way, I guess. Number one, I'm an atheist. That is to say, I do not believe in any God. Number two, I consider myself to be a cultural Catholic. That is to say, I cannot understand myself, nor I don't think can anybody understand me, without realizing the degree to which I've been influenced by having been born into that community. And it is not something I am ashamed of in any way, shape, or form. Thirdly, I consider myself a religious person, but not in any supernatural sense. That is to say, I think religious people are talking about the communion of humanity and perhaps the communion of the cosmos, of there being a meaning in the planet, perhaps beyond the planet, that there is certainly a meaning in humanity, that humanity, having crawled out of the slime, so to speak, I think has done magnificent and terrible things. But I see that community. I resonate to that community. I have a sense of the holy with one small qualification. I do not believe that there is a God at the beginning or at the end. I believe that when I die, I die. At the same time, I believe that in my own terms, I lead a religious life. The sociologist Simmel wants to find a type as a religious person who does not believe, and that's where I would classify myself.
You had edited the Catholic Worker
right.
for a while. Was there a time in your life when politics and religion came together?
Oh, sure. The Catholic Worker was one of the greatest experiences in my life. I worked with Dorothy Day, a woman. I just hope I live long enough to go to the canonization ceremonies for Dorothy Day. And at the Catholic Worker, we took our criticism of Francis Cardinal Spellman, who was the Cold War McCarthyite Cardinal of New York in that period. Strangely enough, as we regarded him as a very poor Catholic, we felt that if you took Christianity seriously, that you had to be on the side of the poor and against the rich and even against rich prelates and the luxuries of the church. And I think that the conception of politics that we have. Well, let me give you one example, which I find fascinating. At that point, I was at the Catholic Worker in 1951-52. We lived in voluntary poverty. We were anti-war. Most of the people there were pacifists. I was a conscientious objector, but not an absolute pacifist during the Korean War. At that time, we were totally marginal in American Catholicism. It was a tiny group of nuts living down on the Bowery, sharing our rooms and our lives with alcoholics, you know, crazy people. And Dorothy Day, history had passed her by. Recently, I was reading the Catholic bishop's pastoral letter on the bomb, and Dorothy Day is mentioned in that letter, but not Francis Cardinal Spellman. And as I read that letter, it does not agree with Dorothy Day. Dorothy Day was much more radical than that. But it has accepted to an extraordinary degree the notion that the question of nuclear policy, the question of deterrence, is a moral question. And that's what Dorothy was trying to say. And I wrote a review of a biography of her about a year ago, and I said, ironically, within a matter of a mere 20, 25 years, it has turned out that Dorothy Day is more influential among the bishops of the Catholic Church than Cardinal Spellman. So I think that I never left the Catholic Worker. I left the belief in the ontological God, who was very, very important to Dorothy Day, who was a theological conservative in her own way. But I never lost that belief in bringing considerations of morality into public life.
Michael Harrington is my guest, and the title of his new book is The Politics at God's Funeral. Can you tell us briefly why you left the church?
Oh, it's theological. I don't usually talk about it. I would say the original sticking point was the notion of hell, was the doctrine of the devil, and above all was the notion that a loving God would consign anyone to eternal hellfire. I was sympathetic. There was a heresy early in the church that eventually Christ would go to hell and redeem all the people in hell, that he would not be able to stand the notion of there being people in hell. Without knowing it, I discovered the heresy much later. Maybe if I discovered the heresy at the time, I simply would have become a heretic rather than an atheist. But I simply the doctrine of hell was my sticking point.
Do you think that what you lost when you left the church, you've gotten through politics, that sense of a moral center and of a philosophy to kind of shape your life with?
But see, I see a continuity. My mother, who died about 3 years ago and was a very devout Catholic to the day of her death, was sort of perplexed as to why her middle-class, middle-Western son becomes a radical. And I used to tell her, and I don't think she ever totally agreed or understood what I was saying, that I thought then, and I think now, that I was applying the principles I had learned in my home, but in a rather different way, that I had made my own interpretation. But I don't see a break. I never felt I broke with the Catholic Worker or even broke with the Catholic Church. Sometimes I think it is not that I'm against the church. I love the church. I just don't believe in it. And that's why I would call myself a cultural Catholic. But I do not believe in it, and that's the fact of the matter.
Do you think that religious people and atheists have a lot of trouble understanding each other?
Oh, I think much less now. I think that certainly one of the great accomplishments, not simply of John 23rd, but precisely of those social movements that brought religious people and atheists together is they understand one another much more. And I think, for example, the civil rights movement at its height. I've always said that black America probably did more for whites than it did for blacks because black America gave whites back their soul. What the civil rights movement had was precisely some sense of a transcendental value, a sense that could motivate young people to leave elite Ivy League colleges and go down to the South where they might get killed by Klansmen. So I think that we've come a long way on that one since when I was a kid and was taught that all socialists were of the devil's party. Now in the world probably there are more Catholics who are socialists than Catholics who are capitalists.
If we had some kind of meeting that you proposed between religious people and atheists who agree on certain values, what would be different than what we have now? Since in any political group, I think, of the left, right, or center, there are religious people and atheists who share certain values and who meet through the commonness of their political party.
Well, but see, I think that's perhaps what I'm doing in the book, in part, is giving an argument for something that has already happened, hasn't happened enough. But one of the interesting things I find about Democratic Socialists of America is we have members who are priests and nuns and rabbis and ministers and members who are atheists. And I think that's very important. We have even the organization is deeply committed to right to choice on the issue of abortion. We have some members. They're a minority, fairly small minority, but they're very decent people who are radical Catholics who are socialists and for the right to life for the same reason. They are not like some of those bishops who would have been against killing Vietnamese fetuses but were willing to kill Vietnamese human beings. These are people who extend that their reverence for life to all life. It has led to tensions at times since the organization is unambiguously for choice, but I think that's tremendous that these differences can exist within a community. And so one of the things the book is perhaps doing is trying to give intellectual reasons and a scaffolding to make stronger what I think did begin in the 1960s, not only in the United States, I think it's happening throughout the advanced world. That I was a professor at the University of Paris last spring for half a semester. And I was in France talking to a lot of people, and the most radical, to my mind, trade union federation in France is the trade union federation in France that grew out of the Catholic workers' movement but became a secular union federation but still with roots in some of those Catholic values, the Confederation of French Democratic Workers, the FDT. So I think it's happening in France. It's happening in Germany. Felipe González, the Prime Minister of Spain, one time I said to him, between when Franco was alive and you were an anti-Franco leader, and now, what is the big change? And Felipe said without a minute's hesitation, the biggest change in Spanish life in the last 50 years is the fact that there are now Catholic priests who are not only members of the Socialist Workers' Party of Spain, but sit as its elected representatives in the Cortes. So Felipe, by the way, was elected in Spain. His party scored a stunning victory, despite the fact that he publicly states that he does not believe in God. I hope America someday might get... One of my jokes has been for some time, in 1960, the country proved that it was ready for a Catholic president. I wonder when it will be ready for an ex-Catholic president. I wonder when religion in that sense, affiliation, simply will not matter. It doesn't in Spain, which is a not un-Catholic country.
My guest is Michael Harrington, if you're just joining us. He's national co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America and author of many books. His latest, the subject of which we've just been discussing, is The Politics at God's Funeral, The Spiritual Crisis of Western Civilization. You're in the process now of completing, or I guess it's already completed, a book that's scheduled to be published in August.
Right.
And it's a sequel, really, to your classic 1962 book, The Other America, which was a study of poverty. This is called The New Poverty. What do you define as the new poverty?
Well, I think that in the 60s, poverty was never as simple a proposition as people thought. The standard attitude in the 60s was there are pockets of poverty in an affluent society. All we need to do is skim a little of the cream off the top, hand it to the people at the bottom, and we'll be in great shape. Actually, had we not gone into Vietnam under the relatively favorable economic circumstances of the 60s, I do think we could have done twice as much, three times as much, four times as much as we did. However, I would argue that today, poverty is more difficult to eradicate than it was in the 1960s. That's not simply because of Ronald Reagan. Reagan makes the worst of a bad situation, in my opinion, but he doesn't cause it. And I think what causes the new poverty is a shift in the international division of labor whereby South Koreans can now make steel more efficiently not only than us, but more efficiently than the Japanese. A multinationalization of corporate capital where corporations now roam the entire globe for materials, workers, etc., drastically reducing the power of unions and workers' organizations. And thirdly, a technological revolution, which I believe is striking not simply at the office in the factory, but it's striking at the office. I think it's going to get to middle management. I think in the next 20 years, anything that can be quantified can be done by a computer. And they've only begun. I think they're going to be eliminating 60,000 a year managers as well as 20,000 a year production workers. Under those circumstances, I think there are actually some new poverties. For example, one new poverty is the poverty of working people, particularly those working people who are, let's say, 40, 45 years of age or more, who are in steel or auto and lose their jobs. Who wants them? If they get a job, they're going to get a job. For example, when a steel worker becomes an electronics worker, he or she loses about 40% of the average wage. There is a catastrophic cut in living standard. So I think that there is going to be a new poverty of the old working class, not the entire old working class, nowhere near it, but some, a significant people who 10 years ago thought they had it made, could now or in the next several years discover that they have to go to AFDC or food stamps or what have you. Secondly, I think that there is a new poverty of the new working class. By the new working class, I mean the undocumented workers, I mean the blacks, I mean the women. Silicon Valley, high tech, supposedly the solution to our problems, is filled with women, Chicanas, Vietnamese, Chinese, very low paid, very close to the poverty line, particularly if they have a large family. They're the undocumented workers. I think one of the things that happens now is you get a curious bifurcation of the American occupational structure. And simultaneously with high tech and computers, there are now sweatshops in most major American cities. We are getting our third world within the United States. The third world in the United States is competitive with the third world outside of the United States. It's often undocumented workers. So those are two new poverties. I think they're the feminization of poverty. That is to say, and this is a problem that's been around. It was around in the 60s, but it has become so much greater. And I think it relates my two books. It relates the new book on poverty to my new book on the politics at God's funeral. The enormous increase in the number of children born out of wedlock, the enormous increase in single-parent families and single-parent families headed by a woman. And single-parent families headed by a woman are at risk on the poverty more than any other family type. So there's a new poverty. It's not brand new. Women, there has been an AFDC kind of poverty a long time. It's much bigger now. And it's not just blacks. Blacks suffer, in this case, as in almost all others, disproportionately and dramatically from the problem. But by no means, it's white, too. It's Hispanic, too. Another new poverty, which many people are aware of, is the street people, which is actually, I think, two or three different poverties lumped together carelessly sometimes. You have the mental patients who were deinstitutionalized, who were supposed to be taken care of, never were, simply dumped out on the streets, sometimes with some pretty potent tranquilizers, which just make them frighten other people sometimes. Then you have homeless people who are homeless because in a place like Manhattan, there has been this enormous gentrification of the single-room occupancy hotels, which were one of the major institutions of the poor in the United States. They're now being turned into condominiums and being refurbished. And with tax breaks, New York City is giving money to create a shortage. And so at least some of the bag ladies, some of the people in the subway, some of the people sleeping on grates where there's heat coming up from the subways or what have you, are there because the city threw them out of their apartments. And finally in New York City, one of the things, particularly in the last winter, the winter of 82-83, is a very significant increase in the number of younger people who are out on the streets. And those are often young minority people, displaced workers, etc. When I was at the Catholic Worker, living on the Bowery in 51-52, most of the people on the Bowery were white. Most of them were 40 or 50 years of age. There were practically no blacks, no Jews. Ethnically, a lot of Irish, a lot of Polish, some Italians. I go back periodically to the Worker. I give speeches there about once every year and a half or so. But I went back to talk to people there. And now the people who line up for the bread line and the soup line at the Catholic Worker tend to be young, tend to be minorities. They're violent. In my day on the Bowery, there was very little violence, or rather the violence that existed was mainly drunken violence where somebody was not going to hurt the person they were fighting. They might hurt themselves by falling down. At the Worker now, they lock the door. In my day, we had the door open during the day. At the Worker now, on the bread line and the soup line, they have to have somebody out there to referee some of the fights that occur. So I'm saying that there are these new poverties, and and I've just really named some. I think there's a new agricultural poverty as well. There's a poverty in places, Maine, for example. I was up in Maine. Poor people all over the lot in Maine.
Let me ask you, does the identification of new poverties mean that there will have to be new kinds of solutions,
oh, sure,
that the old ways of dealing with poverty won't work anymore,
sure,
do you think?
And I think one of the key points here, and I think it's a mistake that some made in the 60s, I made it to begin with, but I got over it pretty quickly, is to say, let us say, to working people, to middle-class people, to students, the poor are suffering disproportionately from the same structural problems that are driving the UAW and the steel workers and the college students are trying to figure out what to do in this crazy economy. They're suffering from the same problems. And to solve the problem of this college student who wants to get into the middle class, to solve the problem of that steel worker I talked to in McKeesport who wants to keep the house and live in McKeesport, you have to also solve the problem of the undocumented workers. And if you let them play off the undocumented against the documented, the union against the non-union, the men against the women, the minorities against the white folks, et cetera, then everybody loses. And I think it has to be radical because I think one of the things, full employment would not solve everybody's problems. Kennedy said, and it's been quoted, Jack Kennedy said, it's been quoted a million times, that a rising tide lifts all boats. And there's one small exception. It lifts all boats except those boats which have holes in them. And metaphorically speaking, there are a fair number of boats in American poverty now which have holes. And you get full employment, and those AFDC mothers, it would help, but a lot of them are going to need more. So, yes, I think that since I think full employment in the 60s was not a terribly radical demand. I think in the 80s, under conditions of technological revolution, shift in the International Division of Labor and so forth, I think full employment is absolutely necessary, but I think it will take a shift in American practices as profound as the New Deal was in its day.
Well, you've said in your New Poverties that it's possible to be employed and poor at the same time.
Sure.
So would you say that full employment wouldn't guarantee you the kind of wage that would get you out of poverty?
Well, let me say something, and I should warn any listener out there who was a professional economist to get the heart attack pills, because this usually makes economists get very nervous. And it's argued in a book called Beyond the Wasteland by David Gordon, Sam Bowles, and Tom Weisskopf, which is coming out shortly in paper. They give a very good argument for it. I think that we have to have what the Swedes call a solidaristic wage policy to raise the wages of the people at the bottom the most. And what that new book argues and what I am for is to have a minimum wage which is equal to the modest but adequate budget published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That would be about a 40% increase in the minimum wage. I think it can be done, but I think it's very radical and would take a lot of planning to deal with the effects of that.
Just briefly, because we're running short on time, one of the debates that has been going on in this country, especially since the election of Ronald Reagan to the presidency, is how much it is the responsibility of the public, the taxpayer, to help people who are poor or unemployed in something like the higher minimum right. wage that you'd be proposing. Whose responsibility would that be, private enterprise or taxpayers? What kind of balance?
Well, for
would,
one thing,
you raise
a critical question, and here it's not just Michael Harrington, but the Black Congressional Caucus has done brilliant work on this. The American tax system is a huge system of relief for the rich. And I would solve many, many of these problems by taking away those multi-billion dollar tax deductions which economically do not promote anything except the wealth of the wealthy. And I think when I talk to union audiences, I often say to union audiences, you think that you are paying too much for the poor. You are absolutely right. You are wrong in thinking that the fault is the fault of the poor. The fault is the fault of a tax system that taxes working people and middle class people much more than it taxes rich people. And you should be angry not at the poor or not at helping the poor, but at a tax system that makes working people, makes union members pay more for welfare than multimillionaires. I think if we had in the United States a moderately progressive federal income tax, that so many of these problems financing problems, many of them would solve themselves. I also think if we got a full employment economy, that generates income. Final point, which a lot of people don't understand, there was a great cliche in the 1950s and 60s, and that was America is affluent because we pay high wages. And now everybody is standing around and congratulating themselves that the steel workers have made concessions and the auto workers have made concessions and all these workers have finally stopped pricing themselves out of the market and hooray, and that's why we're having a recovery. But if all these workers make these concessions, who is going to buy the products that they make? If we downgrade the entire American income structure for the mass, I think we are in danger of making the economy non-viable, not simply for the poor, but for everybody.
Well, we only have 2 minutes left, and I know I've saved very little time for this question, but how do the upcoming elections look from your perspective? For instance, in the Democratic primaries, are there any candidates that you feel are close enough to your perspective to gain your endorsement?
Well, let me say, number one, that any candidate whose name is not Ronald Reagan on the Democratic ticket is, to my mind, preferable. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't have a preference within that, but I think defeating Reagan is the name of the game. Number two, members of Democratic Socialists of America are very involved in the Mondale candidacy, the Jackson candidacy, Cranston, and McGovern. I don't know of any who are for John Glenn, but I guess it's conceivable. Our policy is the organization endorses no one, but we think all of those, I think, for example, that Jackson, by raising some issues, by registering people, I think Jackson, I don't think he's going to get the nomination. I think he can enormously help not only black people, the entire American political system. I think Mondale, who would look most likely, infinitely superior to Reagan. I think that Cranston, by focusing on the freeze, McGovern, etc. So I also think that nobody is good enough yet. I think we have to have something more radical than anybody. And one of the things that we in DSA, we will, when the proper moment comes, reluctantly choose the lesser evil, but we also will fight like the Dickens to get a real alternative to both Reaganomics and the liberalism, which I think is pretty much exhausted. I think we have to go way beyond liberalism if we're going to deal with the problems we've been talking about today.
Well, Michael Harrington, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about some of your ideas. Michael Harrington has been my guest, and he is the national co-chair of DSA, which is the Democratic Socialists of America. And he's the author of the classic 1962 book, The Other America, which was a study of poverty. His book, The New Poverty, is scheduled to be published in August. And his latest book is called The Politics at God's Funeral, The Spiritual Crisis of Western Civilization. And The Politics at God's Funeral is published in hardcover by Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. Michael Harrington will be speaking later today at the House of Our Own bookstore from 5 to 7 o'clock there at 3920 Spruce Street. And for more information, you can call 222-9637. That's 222-9637. And thank you again for talking with us. It's 20 minutes to 5 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Well, you didn't think we were going to forget Valentine's Day, did you? Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from Cynthia Heimel, who is the Village Voice columnist. She writes under the name The Problem Lady and does a kind of tongue-in-cheek advice to the lovelorn type column. She's also the author of the book Sex Tips for Girls. That's coming up in just a couple of minutes after this Fred Astaire recording of A Fine Romance.